Live at Revere Radio Network, revereradio.org, revereradionetwork.com. Click on the Make a Donation button. We're trying to pull in some money. We got a little fundraiser type deal going. We are covering the continuing Obama crisis. The Globe, available in fine supermarkets everywhere. Cover date, June 23rd, 2008. Possibly already available in your area. Cover story: Obama abandoned by his own mother. World exclusive. Childhood shame. He's hiding from America. Let's check that out. Find out what kind of issues Obama has here. Page 30. Obama was dumped by his mom not once but twice. Barack Obama is hiding a shocking secret from America. His own mother rejected him. Sources tell Globe that Obama's mom twice abandoned him as a child to travel the world and pursue passionate romances. Now, as he bids to become America's first African-American president, except, of course, for Warren G. Harding, something we might cover on a future edition of Total Information Radio, and at total411.info, back to the story. Obama fears his enemies will use his childhood heartbreak to attack him on the issue of family values and destroy his White House dream. Obama has tried to portray his mom, Anne, in the media as a loving free spirit, a globe-trotting child of the 60s who helped the poor. But really, sources tell Globe, her double rejection has seriously scarred him. Obama has issues that his enemies could seize on, warns an insider. The Democrat candidate for president hardly mentions Anne in the book he wrote about his absentee dad, Dreams from My Father. When questioned about his mom in a recent TV interview, he was so uncomfortable he changed the subject. And most telling of all, Obama chose not to be at his mother's bedside when she was dying from cancer. Obama probably has problems of insecurity and inner rage at his mother, top Beverly Hills behavioral expert Dr. Lillian Glass explains. So inner rage, it sounds like McCain. He's got hang-ups about rejection. He probably feels guilty about his mother. From the beginning, it was clear that Obama's mom was different than the other girls growing up in Kansas after World War II. She was never particularly interested in children or getting married, said high school friend Maxine Box. But at age 18, while attending University of Hawaii, she became pregnant by a fellow student, Barack Hussein Obama. She dropped out and married the wealthy 24-year-old son of a Kenyan rancher. The marriage was short-lived, however. When Ann found out he had another wife and two sons back in Africa, she ditched him. Ann next married an Indonesian geologist named Lolo Soetoro and moved with him, or maybe it's Soetoro, and moved with him and 6-year-old Obama to Jakarta. That's in Indonesia. After several years in Indonesia, his mother uprooted him again and sent the 10-year-old boy back to Hawaii to live with his grandparents, whom he hardly knew. That marked the first time she abandoned him, sources say, only to break his heart again after her marriage fell apart and she returned to Hawaii for a short time. After a couple of years, Obama's footloose mom left him for good in a 20-year pursuit of a doctorate back in Indonesia. Jesus Christ, that's a long doctoral program. Three times as long as average, at least. Obama was abandoned. The reality is she dumped him not once but twice so that she could pursue her dreams and desires, says the source. Sometimes Obama makes his mother sound like St. Anne, but it's really like he's trying to rewrite his own history and cover up the fact that he was really an abandoned kid, just like thousands and thousands of children in America today. As another insider, his political opponents could use it all against Obama. They can ask, how can you preach family values when you were brought up apart from your parents? How can you be objective on social issues when you're carrying an emotional burden on yourself? It could be devastating to his campaign. And Glass says Obama has to be haunted by the feeling that he was unimportant to his mother. It must have been crushing for a 10-year-old boy to be plucked up from one life in Indonesia and put down alone in a totally different life among strangers, says Glass. That's a crucial time in a child's life. When Ann left her womanizing husband Lolo in 1972 and moved back to Hawaii with her baby daughter Maya, there were hopes she would settle into a normal family life, say insiders. But her reunion with her son was short-lived. After 3 years, Ann, an anthropology student, broke Obama's heart for the second time, sources said, by leaving him behind in Honolulu while she went off to pursue her doctorate in faraway Jakarta, taking Barack's little sister with her. Just when he must have been feeling he was back in her life, she took off again without him, another insider tells Globe. She acted selfishly in going off to follow her own interests or pleasures without her child. She certainly didn't dedicate her life to her son. Hope he doesn't hate white people too much as a result. Moving on here. Obama, meanwhile, decided to dedicate his life to politics and moved to Chicago in the 1980s. That's where he met his wife, Michelle. In 1992, they were married at the Trinity United Church of Christ. Surprisingly, Obama's mom came to the wedding. Then, just as she had done to him as a child, she returned again to Indonesia, says the insider, this time for the last time. 3 years later, she was diagnosed with ovarian cancer and came home to Hawaii to die at age 52. Obama, incredibly, didn't make the trip from Chicago to be with her before she passed. People wonder why Obama wasn't there when his mother died, says one political insider. Was this revenge at being abandoned by her? Did Obama turn the tables and abandon his mother in her time of need? Obama has since admitted that it was the biggest mistake of his life that he wasn't with Ann when she died. But 13 years later, his troubled relationship with his mom continues to haunt him. Obama's actions show that he still has issues about his mother, says Glass. They're hang-ups common to children who've been through the same nightmare. It's the ultimate rejection when even your own mother doesn't care for you. During an interview with NBC's Brian Williams on June 4th, after Obama had won the nomination, Williams asked, how do you think your mother and your father would feel right now? Obama paused and told a story about meeting a supporter at an event the night before that was totally unrelated to the question. Questions about his mother and father will come up again and again in the 5 months until the election. Obama has to make a choice on how he's going to deal with them, says pundit Will Silvestri. Will he escape the unhappy memories of being abandoned, or will that heartache be his political Achilles heel? So, there you go. That is the new cover story from the Globe. Obama abandoned by his own mother. Not too much other news in there. Ted Kennedy wants to be buried at Arlington with JFK and Bobby. The Examiner came out too, by the way. The Examiner tells us that Oprah packs on 50 pounds after Obama says, "We're through!" So there you go. Anyway, since it is the Sabbath, we do want to hear from our new spiritual guru up there in Harlem, Reverend James David Manning. He's going to have a message to preach to us about Obama. Hit us up at revereradio.info to make a donation, and total411.info to get all the news that's fit to pixelate. Here we go. Here are a couple messages from Reverend James David Manning up in Harlem. Keep listening. Later, we're going to get into some of this global warming bullshit.
And you and I together, we will change this country and we'll change the world.
They were watching his power. They were watching the large crowds that were following him. And as the crowds grew larger and his oratory more impressive, I mean, when Hitler spoke, when this man stood before 50 and 100 and 200,000 people, he wooed a crowd like no man on earth had ever done. As I watched this parade of this emissary, this ambassador from hell himself called Barack Hussein Obama, got y'all in a trance. And is trying to bring deception all over the world. And all of the world was watching as Hitler was amassing his power and talking about how he was going to change the world. And talking about the things he was going to do about Germany and making her the greatest race and the greatest people that ever was. And yet no one did a thing. They had likened him, Barack Hussein Obama, to John Fitzgerald Kennedy, our president of America. They likened Barack to him. And then they likened him to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., which I screamed and railed, don't do that. But now, you don't hear them say that anymore. You know why? Because he's so far out ahead of John Kennedy, it ain't, Kennedy never had the popularity and power that this man, I mean, Kennedy would pray for having half of the kind of popularity that Barack had. And Dr. King, I mean, Stokely Carmichael, Rap Brown, Huey Newton, Bobby Seale, and a whole lot of other black people were fighting against Dr. King. But Barack got a kind of unity. King, Lord, if King could have had the unity that Barack had, my God. You know, can I take it one step further? Can I preach this? Not even Jesus is as popular as Barack is. I mean, Billy Graham must be having a fit. He must be one that I've been crusading for 50 years and I've never been able to draw the kind of crowds that Barack has. The Pope was here in April and he only got a few people, but Barack gets everybody. Well, let me repeat that. He gets all of y'all. There's one man standing. He's James David Manning, and I'm not going to bow down. But they watched this man build and amass this power of world domination, and the world that should have been stood by and did nothing. And yet he spoke. And when Hitler stood, the people would come. And you can see, if you go back and look at some of the old news reels of Hitler's speeches, you'll see the people were standing there in awe. Hail Hitler, they would say. You could see the look on their faces as if they were in some sort of trance. And this man spoke with eloquence. This man spoke with power. This man spoke with determination. And every German fell down at his feet and worshiped him. His idea and design was to take charge of the world. Now I know you see where I'm going with this. And I know you see what's happening. All Barack Hussein Obama needs is a mustache. That's all he needs. And an outstretched right arm. And we are repeating history all over again. All over again. Men, women, and children pledged a dying loyalty to Hitler. Hell, Hitler! They pledge a loyalty to him that had never been given to any man that had walked this earth before. They loved him and they worshiped him. You know, I've talked with a large number of people that support Barack. They come around and I see in their eyes, and they're saying really with their eyes, Pastor, I can't help it. I know you told me not to, but Pastor, I can't help it. I love that man. I know you told me, Pastor. I know you told me. I know you're angry with me. I know, but Lord, I love that man, and I can't help myself. There's just something about him. I don't know what it is, but there's just something about Barack Obama. I love him, Pastor. I love him. I know I don't want you to be mad with me, Pastor, but I love this man. I love him. I mean, this man, Hitler, had such an influence over the world that everybody was afraid to stand up against him. Not even the Catholic Church, when Hitler was taking the property of Jews and carting them off to those stations where they were killed, the Catholic Church remained silent. Not one pope, not one priest, not one person. They allowed this man, with his charismatic speech and his great oratory and his ability to sway tens of thousands of people, and no one, not even the pope, raised his voice against the atrocities, the murdering that he was doing. And it went on. And no one stood against this marauding power of hell itself. And Hitler was able to do all that he wanted to do. As I watched this parade of this emissary, this ambassador from hell himself called Barack Hussein Obama, got y'all in a trance. And is trying to bring deception all over the world. But I want to give you a view of what's happening to us at present in this nation from the throne of God, and not from the New York Times or CNN or one of those other devils who've been telling you where the real power lies. Jesus is still on the throne, my son. God still rules. He still rules. And I'm still speaking on his behalf. And I'm God's servant. But not even Jesus. You know what they did to Jesus? They hung him. And the Roman and the Jewish press printed stories that were lies against Jesus. They were against him. Barack's more popular than Jesus. And Dr. King, the great man. But God knows he wasn't as powerful as Barack is. And the religious crowds that followed Jesus were not as powerful as the paralyzed, hypnotic people that follow Barack. The African American people who have treated this man better than they would treat Jesus if Jesus returned. And so you can't say anything about him because he's partially alleged to the African American people. And you know, black people always walk around with a chip on their shoulder because they're black, daring anybody to say anything to them. And our society has been hijacked and kidnapped and pushed into a corner where no one can say anything publicly about black people. If you do, they call you a racist and a bigot. So the true thoughts and true dialogue between white folk and black folk cannot go forward, because you cannot speak your mind or the truth without being called a racist if you say anything about the spirits of black folk, the habits of black folk, the spirit that black folk are full of, black men are full of abandonment, they're full of murder, they're full of robbery, and they're full of violence. Now that is not to say that all black men are, but 70% of them are. 70% of them desert their children. 70% of them don't marry the mothers that they father children through. 1.2 million of them are in prison. And this has nothing to do with white folk or slavery. So you can't, we can't have a true and meaningful dialogue about race in this nation, because if you say anything against black folk, you will be drummed out of town and out of church. So here's what I want to say to you as we go forward to fight this battle. The first thing we're going to have to do, you're going to have to do what I'm doing. You've got to stand up and not be worried about popular opinion or what people say about you or what people think about you. Black people got a chip on their shoulder. If you want to knock it off, knock it off. Knock that chip right off their shoulders. I mean, they knock chips off of everybody else's shoulder. I mean, what is fair is fair. We've got to get rid of what I have referred to as affirmative black social affirmative action, the way we have to walk around eggshells, the way white people have to walk on eggshells around black people, on the job, in the church, and every place else. If you're white, you have to walk on white eggshells so that you don't offend these black people that wear their racism on their shoulder, their blackness on the shoulder, and they wear slavery on their sleeves. This has got to stop. It is hurting the black race. It is destroying the white race. And it's pulverizing our nation in terms of this relation. And we're working together, united, to be able to make for a greater nation and even a greater church to give God the glory. I say unto you, stop, white people. Stop walking on eggshells around black people. I mean, who are they anyway that you got to be so careful about everything you say, everything you do, every place you go, and every turnaround you got to hear slavery. Every other moment you got to hear something about slavery, or you got to hear something about police brutality. I mean, it just needs to stop. And black folk are not going to stop lapping this up and pushing you into a corner and bribing you and making you act like a misfit while you're around them and having you so glad that you're no longer in their presence. When you finally leave work or wherever else you are with them, you can finally relax and be yourself. This has got to stop because it's destroying black people. It has given them a false sense of security, making them think that they don't have to do anything to better their lives, that you are the cause of everything that's going wrong with them. Now, if you white folk are tired, if you are tired, if you're sick and tired of hearing black folk blame you for everything that's wrong with them, stop acting like you are wrong. You are the blame. You are the reason for everything that's wrong with black folk. You're not. So stop acting like it. Knock them chips off of those black folk's shoulders and knock that slavery off of their sleeves. And can an amen and a boom shakalaka go right there? Praise Almighty God. I'm Pastor James David Manning, and we're going to put an end to this mess going on here in America, and we're going to build a great nation of unity. Some people say, well, you know, you shouldn't be preaching about politics in the church, and you shouldn't be preaching about Obama. Well, Mona, can I ask you a question? You believe the Bible, right? The Bible says that there is coming a delusional person that's going to take over the whole world, and we refer to that person as the Antichrist, right? You have a general understanding of the Antichrist, maybe all of your interpretation and understanding the way your theologians or pastors have taught you about it may not be clear, but there's a general consensus that there's one coming who's a smooth talker. I mean, he is a smooth talker. And he is going to take over the world. And the thing about it, when he comes, the church will not stand in his way. Indeed, what the church will do is that the church will roll out the red carpet for this person that's going to be directly against God. This person who will represent more evil than all of the evil that has been done to date, all the wars that have been fought to date, all the murders that have been fought to date, all the poisoning that has been fought to date, all the lying that has been lied to date, all the things of evil that have been done to date. This one person is going to come and going to represent more evil than any of the things that is represented to date. And when he comes, it will be the church that will introduce him, that will praise him, that will support him, that will feed him, that will sleep him, and that it will be the church when the Antichrist comes. It will be the church that will do this when the Antichrist does come. And then everybody else will be deceived by this Antichrist person. Now, you know, if this Antichrist did appear on the scene, I know you love the Lord, don't you think that a preacher should preach against it? You know, don't you think a preacher should get up and say, this man is full of evil. This man, it represents the devil. This man ought not to have the opportunity to enter into anybody's life or hold any kind of office or do any kind of leadership. Don't you think somebody, if the Antichrist comes, don't you think somebody ought to say something about it? I mean, the preacher shouldn't just stay there and say, well, it ain't my job to talk about politics. Not my job to tell people about the love of Jesus. I got to tell people that they need to be baptized in the Holy Ghost. Hallelujah. I got to tell people that they got to walk right. You know, that doesn't make any sense. When all of this, some preacher needs to have enough to connect with God where they can stand up and preach against this Antichrist figure that the Bible says is coming into the earth. And the church and the church people are going to be the one that praise him. I'm amazed at how people think, and they call themselves Christian. But you know, the other thing is that Barack Obama is not the Antichrist. He's not the Antichrist. Because when the Antichrist comes, he's going to deceive everybody. Barack doesn't have there's a whole lot of folk out there that's not deceived by Barack. I'm talking about most Americans got this guy's number. They know he's a phony from the word go. He's a con artist from the word go. He's a closet homosexual. They know that. Everybody knows that. He's not the Antichrist. But and then there's another concrete reason, of course, we can discover that Barack is not the Antichrist, is because when the Antichrist comes, he's going to deceive everybody. Barack is only deceiving the Negro people and the perverted, rebellious, liberal, homosexual the twitching homosexual and lesbian white people. See, those are the two groups that are supporting Barack. He's got the homosexual twitching men, you know, like Tim Russert of the MSNBC News and all these other newscasters and people like Jack Cafferty and all of these twitching homosexuals and these lesbians. And then he got these young rebellious, these young white people from 18 years on up to about 27. They are rebellious as the days are long. They are anti-God. They are for homosexual same-sex marriages. They are anti-establishment. And those are the people that are supporting Barack on the white side. They are rebels. They are liberals. They are baby killers. They are same-sex marriage promoters. Then on the other side, the other leg that supports Barack, all the Negroes, black people, African Americans, all of them, they all think the same way. You can put black folk, no matter whether they got PhDs or whether they got MSDs, they got DDTs, whatever, or they can be ex-convicts. You can put them all in one toe sack and they'll all fall out together when it comes to understanding relationships and identifying themselves before white folk. They do not know God. They don't know who their God is because they're most black folks, God is the white man. Because they tell him, he said he does everything. He makes us do everything. We can't do nothing because the white man. We can't do nothing. Only God can stop a number of people from doing anything. And so white, black folk, are God, they worship white folk as well. And these are the people that are supporting Barack. But the people in the middle understand this man is a closet homosexual. He's a con artist. He's a scam artist. He is a trickster from the word go. And everybody knows it. Coming up out of Chicago, he came out of two of the greatest cesspools in America. Chicago politics is the raunchiest, most violent, bribe-taking, lie-making politicians on the planet. Everybody knows Chicago and Mayor Daley and that group out there that's worse than any local political group around the planet. And then it came out of that Trinity United Church of Christ, which I've called a Trinity of Hell. So he's come out, he got a double whammy. But my thing is this, is that there are a lot of people out there that love me, and I'm definitely going to continue to preach the truth. And any good standing pastor, if the Antichrist comes, should preach against them. And any person that is evil, if the church isn't preaching against it, then it isn't the church. Praise Almighty God.
Barack the Magic Negro lives in D.C. Times they called him that cause he's not authentic like me. Yeah, the guy from the LA paper said he made guilty whites feel good. Their will vote for him and not for me, cause he's not from the hood. See, real black men like Snoop Dogg or me or Farrakhan have talked the talk and walked the walk, not coming late and won. Oh, Barack, the magic Negro lives in D.C. The L.A. Times, they called him that, cause he's black but not authentically. Barack, the magic Negro lives in D.C. The L.A. Times, they called him that, cause he's black but not authentically. Some say Barack's articulate and bright and new and clean. The media sure love this guy, oh, an interloper's dream. But when you vote for president, watch out and don't be fooled. Don't vote the magic Negro in, cause I won't have nothing after all these years of sacrifice. And I won't get justice. This is about justice. This is about me. It's about justice. It's about buffet. I'm not having no buffets. There's not gonna be any church contribution. And there ain't no cash in the collection plate. There ain't gonna be no cash money. No walking.
Reverend James David Manning. And whoever it was singing that song, Peter, Paul, and Mary, I guess. Puff. Magic. Actually, there's an interesting story. Let's see if we can pull it up here. NASA has a probe on Mars. And supposedly, even though, you know what, we saw the face on Mars 30 years ago, they're going to finally tell us whether or not there's life on Mars through this thing here. This probe, it's digging into the soil on Mars. But the interesting thing is, someone appeared on the radio a few months ago and appeared to already know what we were going to find there on Mars. So let's see if we can't find that audio first, and then we're going to read the news story. So here we go. This is going to be our good friend William Shatner just a couple months ago. Let's see what Shat has to say.
Do you believe in extraterrestrial life?
Of course. It is beyond a certainty
William Shatner.
That there is life out there. Just mathematical certainty. The way life takes place and the tenacity with which life holds and the extreme conditions under which life can take place, that there is no question that there is life in outer space and in the other galaxies and in our galaxy, I'm sure. And I'm going to let you in on a little secret that I've been told not to reveal. So I won't reveal who told me, but there is going to be information about Mars that won't be too long away about the existence of life.
Life as we know it?
No.
Biological
no,
life?
No.
I mean carbon-based
well,
life?
Well, we
know life. Life means we all are carbon-based entities.
Yes,
I mean,
but two arms and two legs.
Well.
And a frontal eye. No, not necessarily.
Not like as we understand it.
No. But life as we defined it, mm-hmm. which is something that, that can replicate itself, mm-hmm. is one of the definitions of it. That is a certainty.
Wow.
And it may very well be on Mars when the next vehicle gets there. It will have the facility to look under the ground into the water areas. There is a great deal of opinion that they're going to find life. My quote deal is on it.
So anyway, there you have it. Shatner seemed to be getting tipped off from his buddies because what's going on right now is Phoenix. And you can just see this. It's all over. Just Google NASA Mars Phoenix. For instance, the Los Angeles Times says, although NASA has been sending out spacecraft to other worlds for more than three decades, Phoenix is the first to search for water, the foundation of life as we know it. The craft landed on Mars on May 25th after a 296-day journey. So what they mean when they say that Mars is the first to search for life, the Phoenix is the first craft to search for life on Mars, it's the first one they're telling us about. They already know there's water, and, you know, there's, like, actual real-time space aliens. They've known that for decades, too. This is all just fucking... This is all for play. And the funny thing is there are people who built that thing who don't know it's for play, so... And that's why all this shit costs so much. Anyway, as you probably know, one of the things both Obama and McCain are into, and we've talked about this last week, is cap and trade. They're going to limit how much carbon dioxide you breathe, you exhale, because we exhale. First they're going to say it's for cars and manufacturing plants. Anyway, we got a clip here of Václav Klaus, the president of Czechoslovakia, who's been fighting Gore on all this, because this would totally cripple the world economy, and, you know, it would just tax energy and strangle us and achieve the Illuminati's goal of population reduction. So there's a new English translation of his book, Blue Planet, Green Shackles.
Madam President, ladies and gentlemen, it's really a great pleasure to be here. I'm just surprised to hear that I'm skeptical vis-a-vis environmentalism. I'm not skeptical. I'm totally against it, you know. That skeptical is an understatement, you know, which I would never use. You know. As I said, it's a real pleasure to be here. Let me thank all those who helped to make the English translation and publication of my book Blue Planet in Green Shackles possible, especially Fred Smith and his Competitive Enterprise Institute, and to thank those who co-organized the presentation of it in this very prestigious place. Thank you very much. I am really excited to finally hold in my hands, and I got it yesterday at the airport here in Washington for the first time, you know, to hold in my hands, after the Czech, German, and Dutch editions, the English version of this book of mine. The authors often claim that their books speak for themselves. I cautiously agree, and will therefore speak not about the book itself, but about my motivations to write the book. To make my position and my message clear, and this is something what was mentioned in the introduction, I should probably revoke my personal experience. My today's thinking is fundamentally influenced by the fact that I spent most of my life under the communist regime, which ignored and brutally violated human freedom. And as I remember quite well, wanted to command not only the people, but also the nature. To command wind and rain is one of the famous slogans I remember since my childhood. This experience taught me that freedom and rational dealing with the environment are indivisible. It formed my relatively very sharp views on the fragility and vulnerability of free society and gave me a special sensitivity to all kinds of factors which may endanger it. I would like to stress that I do not live in the past and do not see the future threats to free society coming from the old and old-fashioned communist ideology. The name of the new danger will undoubtedly be different, but its substance will be very similar. they will be the same attractive, to a great extent pathetic, and at first sight quasi-noble idea that transcends the individual in the name of something above him, of something greater than his poor self, supplemented by enormous self-confidence on the side of those who stand behind it. Like their predecessors, they will be certain that they have the right to sacrifice man and his freedom to make their idea reality. In the past, it was in the name of the masses or of the proletariat, this time in the name of the planet. Structurally, it is very similar. The current danger, as I see it, is environmentalism, and especially its strongest version, climate alarmism. Feeling very strongly about it and trying to oppose it was the main reason for putting my book together, originally in Czech language, in the spring of 2007. It has also been the driving force behind my active involvement in the current climate change debate and behind my being the only head of state who in September 2007 at the UN Climate Change Conference in New York City openly and explicitly challenged the undergoing global warming hysteria. My central concern is, in a condensed form, as was mentioned by Madam President, captured in the subtitle of this book. I ask, what is endangered, and climate or freedom? And my answer is, it is our freedom, and I may add, and our prosperity. The book was written by an economist who happens to be in a relatively high political position. I don't deny my basic paradigm, my economic way of thinking, because I consider it an advantage, not a disadvantage. By stressing that, I want to say that the climate change debate in a wider and the only relevant sense should be neither about several tenths of a degree of Fahrenheit or Celsius, about the up and or down movements of sea level, about the depths of ice at North and Southern Poles, nor about the variations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. The real debate is and should be about costs and benefits of alternative human actions, about how to rationally deal with the unknown future, about what kind and size of solidarity with much wealthier future generations is justified, about the size of externalities and their eventual appropriate internalization, about how much to trust the impersonal functioning of the markets in solving any human problem, including global warming, and how much to distrust the very visible hand of very human politicians and their bureaucrats. Some of these questions are touched upon in my book. My deep frustration has been exponentially growing in recent years by witnessing the fact that almost everything has already been said, that all rational arguments have been used, and that in spite of that, global warming is still marching on. It could be even true that we are now at the stage where mere facts, reason, and truth are powerless in the face of the global warming propaganda. we have probably and regretfully already reached that stage now. The whole process is already in the hands of those who are not interested in rational ideas and arguments. It is in the hands of climatologists and other related scientists who are highly motivated to look in one direction only, because a large number of academic careers has evolved around the idea of man-made global warming. It is further in the hands of politicians who, through the manipulation of people, maximize the number of votes they seek to get from the electorate. It is also as a consequence of these political decisions in the hands of bureaucrats, of national and more often of international institutions, who try to maximize their budgets and years of careers as well, regardless of the costs, truth and rationality. It is finally in the hands of rent-seeking business people who are, given the existing policies, interested in the amount of subsidies they are receiving and look for all possible ways to escape the for them often merciless, but for the rest of us, very positive general welfare enhancing functioning of free markets. An entire industry has developed around the funds the firms are getting from the government. As I promised, I will not describe the book, Madam President, really. So, nevertheless, I have to say that the basic questions of the current climate change debate are sufficiently known and well-structured. Four of them are crucial. The question number one: do we live in an era of a statistically significant, non-accidental and non-cyclical climate change? This is for me the question number one. Question number two: if so, is it dominantly man-made? Question number three: if so, should such a moderate temperature increase bother us more than many other pressing problems we face, and should it receive our extraordinary attention? Question number three. And the final question: if we want to change the climate, can it be done? And are current attempts to do so the best allocation of our scarce resources? My answers are somehow in the book. But to summarize them, I would say that my answer to all these questions is no. No, but with a difference in emphasis. I am not myself fighting about the first question. I don't aspire to measure the global temperature or to correct the measurements of climatologists. And I even do not estimate the relative importance of factors which influence it. I'm an economist, and I always try to take use of my comparative advantages. It's a mistake to do something else. And in those two questions, I don't have a comparative advantage. But to argue, as it is done by many contemporary environmentalists, that these questions have already been answered with a consensual yes, and that there is an unchallenged scientific consensus about this, is unjustified. And not only unjustified, it is also morally and intellectually deceptive. And this is something what I can't live with, and therefore my book and my involvement in this grand global warming debate. As I said, you may find some of my arguments concerning these issues in this book. I always suppose that it's much bigger, but you know, it has 100 pages, whereas the Czech version has 150, and German version even more. And it may be that the English is more productive, more efficient language. That's one possible explanation, which probably creates the advantages of your great country, Madam President. When you have an efficient language, that may be good. But I understood that there is a different story. I have not yet seen in my life a book which has the letters of, which has the text so low to the end of the page and too much to one side or another. When I saw it at the airport yesterday night, I was rather disappointed. But now I understood that it's quite different, and I understood that I should be consistent. And I understood that Fred Smith, the president of the Competitive Enterprise Institute, the publisher of the book, is consistent also. And he is saving energy and paper and put as many letters on one page as is possible. And therefore, the book looks shorter than it really is, you know. This is a miraculous result, which I must say it took me, Fred, it took me several hours to understand that trick, but this is part of the story. We discussed that all of you, I understood, enjoyed having your water with ice. I was the only voice in the room today to ask, please, can I get it without ice? And then my neighbors at the table started to argue, this is very European, because in Europe they have small refrigerators and they don't have enough ice. And I said, Fred, to be consistent, you should go home this evening to throw away your big refrigerator and to buy a new small one. That's the only way how to follow prescriptions of Mr. Al Gore. Thank you very much for your attention.
Václav Klaus, President of the Czech Republic, talking about how this crazy carbon credit thing is going to kill us all. And the new thing is, you're all going to have your lights are going to be full of fluoride and mercury. So I hope everyone enjoys that. And Obama's green shirts will make you do it. Right now, the green shirts are they're causing quite a stir, because at that same venue where Václav Klaus spoke, the National Press Club, scheduled on Wednesday, is Larry Sinclair, who we've heard from and heard of on this program before, who says he himself participated and has witnesses to Obama taking time off from the state legislature to smoke some crack. And I believe Obama wants to keep the federal war on crack alive. So, and word of this got out because it's on the schedule and the media can just be there. The media hang out there. And the alert went out on Daily Coast, CIA Lee Coast, run by this guy Marcos, who was supposedly only went to CIA school and decided not to go to the CIA, but instead to run a large internet activism portal. So CIA Lee Coast is having everyone call the press club and demand that they undermine their core values of free speech and cancel Larry Sinclair and his lawyer and all the documents that has been filed with the Chicago police and everything else. So the brown shirts are out in force. Anyway, impeachment. Katrina, Dennis Kucinich filed 35 articles of impeachment against the criminal president George W. Bush. One of those articles involved what happened with Katrina. So let's check that out and then maybe return for some analysis. Among the other articles of impeachment, by the way, were ones regarding 9/11. All right, here we go. Dinsky Sinich on the floor of the House. Go to rearradio.info, make a donation.
Article 31. Katrina. Failure to plan for the predicted disaster of Hurricane Katrina, failure to respond to a civil emergency. In his conduct, while President of the United States, George W. Bush, in violation of his constitutional oath, to faithfully execute the office of President of the United States, and to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and in violation of his constitutional duty under Article 2, Section 3 of the Constitution, to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, has both personally and acting through his agents and subordinates failed to take sufficient action to protect life and property prior to and in the face of Hurricane Katrina in 2005, given decades of foreknowledge of the dangers of storms to New Orleans and specific forewarnings in the days prior to the storm. The President failed to prepare for the predictable and the predicted disasters, failed to respond to an immediate need of which he was informed, and has subsequently failed to rebuild the section of our nation that was destroyed. Hurricane Katrina killed at least 1,282 people, with 2 million more displaced. 302,000 housing units were destroyed or damaged by the hurricane. 71% of those were low-income units. More than 500 sewage plants were destroyed. More than 170 point source leakages of gasoline, oil, or natural gas. More than 200 gas stations submerged. Several chemical plants, 8 oil refineries, and a Superfund site was submerged. 8 million gallons of oil spilled. Toxic materials seeped into floodwaters and spread through much of the city and surrounding areas. The predictable increased strength of hurricanes, such as Katrina, has been identified by scientists for years. And yet the Bush administration has denied this science and restricted such information from official reports, publications, and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Agency's website. Donald Kennedy, editor-in-chief of Science, wrote in 2006 that, quote, hurricane intensity has increased with oceanic surface temperatures over the past 30 years. The physics of hurricane intensity growth has clarified and explained a thermodynamic basis for these observations. Emanuel's tested this relationship and presented convincing evidence, unquote. Now, the Federal Emergency Management's 2001 list, FEMA's 2001 list, of the top three most likely and most devastating disasters were a San Francisco, this is their 2001 list, San Francisco earthquake, a terrorist attack in New York, and a Category 4 hurricane hitting New Orleans, with New Orleans being the number one item on that list. FEMA conducted a five-day hurricane simulation exercise in 2004, Hurricane Pam, mimicking a Katrina-like event. This exercise combined the National Weather Service, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, the LSU Hurricane Center, and other state and federal agencies, resulting in the development of emergency response plans. The exercise demonstrated, among other things, that thousands of mainly indigent New Orleans residents would be unable to evacuate on their own. They need substantial government assistance. These plans, however, were not implemented in part due to the president's slashing of funds for protection. In the year before Hurricane Katrina hit, the president continued to cut budgets and deny grants to the Gulf Coast. In June of 2004, the Army Corps of Engineers' levy budget for New Orleans was cut. And it was cut again in June of 2005, this time by $71.2 million, or a whopping 44% of the budget. As a result, the Army Corps of Engineers was forced to suspend any repair work on the levees. In 2004, FEMA denied a Louisiana disaster mitigation grant request. The president was given multiple warnings that Hurricane Katrina had a high likelihood of causing serious damage to New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. At 10 a.m. on Saturday, the 28th of August, 2005, the day before the storm hit, the National Weather Service published an alert titled, "Devastating Damage Expected." Printed in all capital letters, the alert stated that most of the area will be uninhabitable for weeks, perhaps longer. At least one half of well-constructed homes will have roof and wall failure. Power outages will last for weeks. Water shortages will make human suffering incredible by modern standards. The Homeland Security Department was also briefed, and also briefed the president on the scenario, warning of levee breaches and severe flooding. According to the New York Times, quote, a Homeland Security Department report submitted to the White House at 1:47 a.m. on August 29th, hours before the storm hit, said, any storm rated Category 4 or greater will likely lead to severe flooding and or levee breaching, unquote. These warnings clearly contradict the statements made by President Bush immediately after the storm that such devastation could not have been predicted. On the 1st of September 2005, the president said, I don't think anyone anticipated the breach of the levees. The president's response to Katrina by way of FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security was criminally delayed, indifferent, and inept. The only Federal Emergency Management employee posted in New Orleans in the immediate aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, Marty Bahamonde, emailed head of FEMA, Michael Brown, from his BlackBerry device on August 31, 2005, regarding the conditions. The email was urgent and detailed and indicated the situation is past critical. Estimates are many will die within hours. Brown's reply was emblematic of the administration's entire response to the catastrophe. Thanks for the update. Anything specific I need to do or tweak? The Secretary of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, did not declare an emergency, did not mobilize the federal resources, and seemed to not even know what was happening on the ground until reporters told him. On Friday, August 26, 2005, Governor Kathleen Blanco declared a state of emergency in Louisiana, and Governor Haley Barbour of Mississippi followed suit the next day. Also on that Saturday, Governor Blanco asked the president to declare a federal state of emergency, and on the 28th of August 2005, the Sunday before the storm hit, Mayor Nagin of New Orleans declared a state of emergency in New Orleans. This shows that local authorities responding to federal warnings knew how bad the destruction was going to be and anticipated being overwhelmed. Failure to act under these circumstances demonstrates gross negligence. In all of these actions and decisions, President George W. Bush has acted in a manner contrary to his trust as president and subversive of constitutional government, to the prejudice and cause of the cause of law and justice, and to the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Wherefore, President George W. Bush, by such conduct, is guilty of an impeachable offense warranting removal from office.
The article regarding the impeachment over Katrina, pretty good. He talked about the drills that they had the year before. That, of course, was an indication that the whole thing was scripted, just like 9/11 was. It had so many drills. A lot of times when they're going to do a false flag on an area in the U.S., they'll run the drill beforehand, and it's, you know, supposedly to help everyone get better prepared, but really they find out what the weakness of the locals are, and then they use that to fuck them over when they do the false flag later on. And we saw that in Katrina, and we saw that some with 9/11. Ron Paul, he's going to tell us about the true cost of the Iraq War.
Hello, this is Ron Paul with your weekly update for June 16th. What is the importance of the war in Iraq relative to other current issues? This is a question I'm often asked, especially as Americans continue to become increasingly aware that something is very wrong with the economy. The difficulty with the way the question is often asked relates to the perception that we are now somehow able to divide such issues or to isolate the cost of war into arbitrarily defined areas such as national security or international relations. War is an all-encompassing governmental activity. The impact of war on our ability to defend ourselves from future attack and upon America's standing in the world is only a mere fraction of the total overall effect that war has on our nation and the policies of our government. The cost of this particular war is enormous, and therefore it's of great importance. There is no single issue that is more important at this particular time. The war has, of course, made us less safe as a nation and damaged our credibility with allies and hostile nations alike. Moreover, years of growing deficits have been spurred on by the high price tag of war and the decision to pay that price primarily by supplemental spending rather than traditional on-budget accounting. War takes what would otherwise be productive economic capacity and transfers both that capacity and the wealth it would generate in normal peaceful times into far less economically viable activities. It also impacts budget priorities in ways that are detrimental to our nation. I've often pointed to the fact that we are building bridges in Iraq while they are collapsing in the United States. All war, but most particularly war funded by monetary inflation, leads the country in multiple ways. Obviously, many of the young people who are in the military literally give their blood and sometimes their lives fighting in wars of this type. Meanwhile, those who do not fight the war but fund it are forced to pay both the immediate costs as well as seeing their long-term purchasing power erode as the twin pillars of debt and inflation are foisted upon the backs of current taxpayers and future generations. Neither conspiracy nor coincidence explains steep increases in the price of gas as the war drags on. No, this is simply a reality of the inflationary policies that, among other things, make this war possible. As people are continually asked to choose whether our nation's teetering economy or the failed foreign policy of the past several decades is most important as we look forward, it is well for those of us who understand that these two issues are closely linked to continue to explain this fact to our fellow citizens. To fix the problem requires a proper diagnosis. Thanks for calling this update.
No problem, Ron. Bye. No problem, Ron. All right.